policing gender roles. A major thrust of the Islamic Republic's social and moral mission was to police gender roles. Despite paying lip service to women's elevated status in the constitution and widespread rhetoric about restoring women's sublime motherly status, the Islamic Republic essentially viewed women with a patriarchal eye and treated them accordingly, or at least tried to. The male-favouring standards of the enforced Sharia, as interpreted by the regime and its jurists, consciously resisted gender equality. Uninformed and unaffected by the discourse of feminism, these standards came to determine not only women's physical appearance, but also their social and familial roles, legal status, and civil rights. The ultimate marker for the new Islamic gender, predictably, was the mandatory use of the hijab and the regime's obsessive enforcement of chastity standards. Threatened with the pain of humiliating arrests, detention, lashing, and monetary penalties, women, the younger generations in particular, were forced to abide by the redefined standards of Islamic modesty. Wearing the hijab, as murals and banners cautioned the public in the streets, stores, and restaurants, was a religious duty upon which was erected the foundation of the Islamic Revolution. Under the rubric of restoring women's dignity and rescuing them from the superficiality of Pahlavi pseudo-modernity, a set of frequently repeated clichés in the regime's anti-modernity rants aimed at associating secularized women with stereotypes of immodest attire, garish makeup, and sexual laxity. In this fixed outlook, sexuality became the cornerstone of any male-female relationship. Any retreat of the headscarf showing a dash of women's hair, any shrinking in the length of the Islamic overalls, rupush, a touch of bright colour, any showing of the natural female contour, the use of cosmetics, even nail polish, all were seen as potent mediums for arousing uncontrollable male sexuality. Hence, they were subject to strict policing. All through the first two decades of the Republic, the morality police, the dreaded Patrol of God's Vengeance, Gashte Sar Allah, terrorized women in the capital and larger cities. They detailed a litany of moral transgressions that included the length of fingernails, the height of heels, and shades of hair highlighting. The never-ending chastity enforcement campaigns not only revealed a fetishistic obsession with the female body, but also an element of class warfare, for they set up poorer people with religious proclivities to inspect and correct the vices of a secularized middle class. A sense of empowerment was well evident in the conduct of the chastity police when encountering their terrified detainees. Nonconformity with the Islamic Republic's morality code, nonetheless, persisted among many women and men. Undeterred by prospects of humiliation and punishment, they hailed passive resistance as an article of faith against absurd practices of the Islamic regime. Obsession with the human body, especially the female body, had a deep history in the Shi'i jurisprudence, for it served as the regulatory principle for enforcing hijab, gender segregation, and other controlling practices in the Islamic Republic and in its courts, schools, offices, and prisons. Shi'i jurisprudence viewed the vagina, rahem, as primal unit for kinship and family loyalties and legal rights, and henceforth demanded from the male members of the family and clan that they safeguard it. The Ayatollah's detailed descriptions in their books of explication of problems, Tawdizul Masail, a dissertation-like requirement for acquiring marja'iyat in the 20th century, in part spelled out intricate rules conducive to such a defense. For the general public, these were the most accessible juristic productions coming out of madrasas of Qom and Najaf, aimed to regulate the lives of the followers. They were unapologetic representations of male superiority formed in a male-only public environment. Among other means, these books of explication offered meticulous instructions about female reproductive organs, virginity, menstrual cycles, rules of sexual intercourse, manners of male penetration, ejaculation, and the handling of bodily fluids. They were also concerned with dress code and head covering for men and women, rules of intimacy, lawful interaction with the opposite sex, gender boundaries, segregation rules, and methods of sheltering women in residential confinement and outside. In all, the explication genre revealed deep anxieties about the human body, and the dangers of allowing it to become undisciplined. The moral code it advanced was the guiding principle behind the Gashtesar Allah and similar Sharia-inspired moral policing. Beyond enforcing a Sharia-prescribed bodily code, the essentially misogynistic clerical culture of Qom embarked on a systematic rewriting of women's civil and legal rights in the Islamic Republic. It reversed much of the achievements of the late Pahlavi era. Marriage and family laws were drastically rewritten along old patriarchal lines. Uninhibited polygamy was reintroduced. The age of marriage for females was lowered according to the dictates of the Sharia. Under most circumstances, divorce was redefined as the sole prerogative of the husband, and children's custodianship was primarily granted to the husband and paternal relatives. Compliance, tamkin, with the husband's sexual desires and abiding by his patriarchal superiority, rules that were endorsed by legislation and backed by the Sharia, turned women, at least on the surface, into objects of control and instruments of pleasure. Restrictions on the social life of women and men, severe though they were, soon were to be balanced by deeper currents in Iranian society and outbursts of generational energies. Most remarkable, perhaps, was the growth and greater democratization of higher education, an unexpected outcome, as far as the Islamic Republic was concerned, of the demographic shifts of the 1970s and 1980s. Building new universities, institutes of higher education, and medical and vocational schools were among the Islamic Republic's priorities. Higher education, far more accessible than the Pahlavi era to both men and women, created a new college-educated generation, which, though energetic and ambitious, could not be absorbed promptly into the workforce. Despite restrictions on choice of professional field, women excelled in higher education because, by contrast to men, who were expected to enter the job market and support their family, women were able to continue their education, at times despite pressures to marry at an early age. The rapid growth of the universities, whether public, semi-private, or private, increased the available opportunities. The Azad University system, a private institution with the state's informal backing, championed the new trend. Branching out in large cities and small towns throughout the country, its often small campuses had low budgets and were ill-equipped, but they enabled, for a fee, hundreds of thousands of students to receive higher education who otherwise would have had little chance of entering more established universities. With flexible curricula and makeshift staffing, these private universities brought unprecedented geographical and, in effect, social mobility. Young women and men enrolled in universities far away, moved out of their homes and hometowns, and learned to live independently along with cohorts from other towns and provinces. The separation from family and late absorption into the workforce facilitated a break from what had become provincial cocoons and, for women in particular, an escape from patriarchal bonds. The widening of intellectual horizons created new lifestyles and new expectations for careers and marriage. In larger cities, while the marriage age gradually rose as birth rates declined, the new middle classes felt even more starkly the absence of employment and career opportunities. By 1986, only about 6% of women were employed outside the home, and women's literacy rate stood at 65%, a discrepancy more pronounced in the mid-1990s, when the percentage of women in Iranian universities surpassed 50% of the total student body, and afterward steadily grew. More visible and more confident, younger women of post-revolutionary generations constituted a voiceless but palpable source of social discontent, at odds with the male-dominated elite of the Islamic Republic and their desire to keep women on the margins of, if not entirely outside, the public space. In some respects, the societal dynamics of the post-revolutionary era gave younger women far greater agency than today's clerical elite ever anticipated. Voices and visions of dissent. A stable but repressive order did not remain free of voices of dissent. As a space of resistance, one can detect in the emerging culture of the post-revolutionary times a degree of continuity with the 1960s and 1970s. Despite the state's stark intrusions through censorship, restrictions, and manipulation, innocuously called Islamic guidance, culture and art remained bastions of Iranian individuality. Music, cinema, visual arts, poetry, and fiction not only survived waves of Islamification, but almost miraculously thrived. They managed to bypass, often in a language of symbolism, the diehard obscurantism, ideological hurdles of the state's cultural bureaucracy, and mirror, with subtlety, the untold sentiments of their eager audiences. The palpable vitality of this eventful era complemented the reformist aspirations that brought Khatami to power, but with deeper roots. In the early days of the revolution, when high hopes for a new liberating space were not yet entirely lost, a large sector of younger Iranians, and some veterans of earlier political struggles, could rejoice in a momentary dawn of freedom. In October 1979, the Persian lyricist Hushang Ebtehaje, born 1928, with the sobriquet Sayyeh, Shadow, composed a poignant ghazal entitled Sepideh, The Dawn, to be recited in the joyous Mahur mode by the master of Persian classical music, Mohammad Reza Shajarian, born 1940. Performed in a public concert attended by thousands and soon distributed nationwide on cassette tapes, the lyrics and music captured the mood of the time. Just as he was achieving new heights in his amazingly long singing career, Shajarian, along with some of the best instrumentalists of the time, led by the composer and tar virtuoso Mohammad Reza Lotfi, 1947-2014, conveyed Ebtehaj's nostalgic message to a new generation. Underscoring continuity with the past, the poet stressed that the success of the revolution was indebted to the long and painful struggle of past generations. Time has drawn your name in the new lot of fortune. Be joyful. The world is now turning in your favour. Oh, in this air, how breaths are so full of fire, and yet joy. For this is the fragrant incense of our hearts that fills your nostrils. Remember the furnace of our burning breasts, where in the fire of our hearts your raw clay was baked. The glow of one diamond from the treasure box of our hearts is now the morning light dawning upon your rooftops. It was through the mirror-like virtue of those who rise at dawn that the sun's radiant visage was cast upon your night sky. Time is now handing you the reins of fortune, for you are reined by the hands of wisdom. The bird of fortune that was fleeing the earth has landed and is pecking seeds in the safety of your net. Saddle the horse of fortune under your questing loins, for you've tamed the heavens as you did the beast of the earth. Revel now in freedom's pleasure palace with Sayyeh's lyrics, so that your cups may brim with the wine of joy. To the bitter disappointment of the poet's audiences, for most Iranians there was little wine of joy, nor was there a pleasure palace of freedom, and certainly not any flight of the bird of fortune. The mirror-like virtue of those who rise at dawn, presumably a veiled reference to Khomeini and the religious message of the revolution, proved wishful thinking. Yet there were plenty of burning breasts within which to bake the raw clay of new generations of Iranians. Modern Persian poetry, of which Ebtehaje offered some of the best in the neoclassical genre, however, was passed over as the predominant medium of artistic expression. Along with it was eclipsed a messianic yearning for a redemptive revolution. Modern poetry since Nimar's time, despite masterful refinement, seems to have reached its limits, even if great poets of the 1960s generation such as Farooq, Akhavan Sales, Shamlou, Sepehri, and Mohammad Reza Shafi'i Kadkani, born 1939, making great poetry. A long poem by Akhavan Sales in the classic genre of Ghasideh, with the opening line, "Of the absurdity of the world, if anything I love. You, my old homeland, you I love," marked a new height in the neoclassical style. Composed in the post-revolutionary years, it illustrated the intricacies of Akhavan's style, his masterful yet accessible language, and the richness of his nostalgia for his country's past and for its fast-changing culture and natural environment, a poetic maturity that went beyond chauvinism and ideology. Whether modern or classic, however, it seemed as if a millennium-old tradition of Persian poetry were about to give way to a new medium of images. A verbal revolution of sorts had gradually dried up poetic creativity, even though appreciation of select modernist and classics, such as Ferdowsi and Hafez, remained strong. Instead, the growing fascination with cinematic imagery in the post-revolutionary era reflected a new artistic dynamism. Although Iran had a film industry since the 1930s, the new shift to cinematic language reflected a desire to move beyond words, whether poetry or prose. Fascination with cinema also reflected an earlier appeal of foreign films, ranging from Italian neorealism to highbrow cinemas of India and Japan, and to Hollywood extravaganzas. Enthusiastic filmmakers and movie buffs, despite the severe ban on corrupting foreign films, turned to cinema as an effective means of cultural interconnectedness. The wider availability of video cassettes, starting in the mid-1980s, and a robust underground distribution network made this possible. The focus of Iranian art house filmmakers, however, was somewhat different from contemporary currents outside Iran. A new sense of cultural confidence among younger filmmakers allowed for an endogenous cinematic language to grow. Iranian independent filmmakers exerted torturous effort to cope with the mandatory Islamic code for the performing arts and to pass the absurd censorship so as to get across their poignant message of social criticism or philosophical musings. With the refreshing honesty that characterized much of Iranian cinema's new wave, the filmmakers' cameras subtly but unapologetically examined taboos that had barely been touched on in Iranian films or any other media. Issues such as the plight of women in a patriarchal society, children's deprivation, violence and socio-ethnic biases, drug addiction, prostitution and the underworld, as well as class divides and poverty, the dreariness of everyday life, double standards and muddled ethics, shades of religiosity, intellectual despair and the search for alternatives, and even clerical hypocrisy, became powerful counterweights to the regime's deceptive portrayal of the pious life in the paradise of the Islamic Republic. By far, neorealism ruled supreme among Iranian filmmakers of the 1980s and 1990s, even though they were mostly obliged to work within the genre of children's films to secure funding and pass the censors. The film department of the Organization for the Intellectual Development of Children and Young Adults, one of the more successful institutions established in 1965 with the patronage of Queen Farah, had a lasting impact on filmmakers of the next generation. Bashu, 1986, released in 1989, by the gifted playwright and filmmaker Bahram Bezai, born 1938, and produced by the Children and Young Adults Organizations, was one of the first in the post-revolutionary era to address the delicate issue of ethnic diversity and national integrity while the Iraq-Iran war was raging. The main character, Bashu, a little stranger, as the subtitle informs us, is a dark-skinned teenage Arab-Iranian refugee from the war-torn Persian Gulf provinces who, having lost his family in Iraqi raids, in distress climbs in the back of a passing truck that brings him the next day to a serene but alien village in the Caspian province of Gilan. Given shelter by a woman villager, Na'i, who takes pity on him, they bond in near silence, despite their own doubts and each other's suspicions. Bashu does not understand the Gilaki dialect of northern Iran, nor does Na'i comprehend the Arabic dialect of the south. The drama reaches a climax when Na'i's husband returns. He is a disabled war veteran, who, apparently by dictate of the censor, was portrayed as returning from a failed job search in the city, a male symbol who is absent throughout the story, but appears at the end as a nuisance, resisting the true mother-child bond that has developed against all odds between one from the north and one from the south. The thinly veiled patriotic message of the movie is devoid of any Islamic component and free of Tehran-centric sentiments, even though Persian is the only means of communication. The unifying message of the film? Iranians moving beyond ethnicity, language, and race, and presumably religion, if Bashu is to be considered a Sunni, may well be interpreted as Bezai's foresight about Iran's emerging society, when the demographic melting pot of the post-war era dissolves regional barriers and removes hollowed and soulless, yet terrifying, symbols of authority. In the last scene, Bashu, along with other village boys, runs across the rice fields assailing a black scarecrow, which symbolizes throughout the film the intimidating male power of the state. Bas Kiarostami, 1940-2016, another filmmaker of the 1970s who started with children's films, left his lasting mark on post-revolutionary cinema, but also became a major cultural figure of the period. His poetic, philosophical approach to cinema, both in subject and in technique, offered an inward view. His existential soul-searching, with a touch of humour, palpable even in his treatment of social themes, was followed by other filmmakers inspired by his enigmatic message. Creating a pictorial rendering of Persian mystical poetry, he portrayed with a stoic eye the rhythm of the ordinary lives of the people of towns and villages, which are fast disappearing. Theirs, he reminds his viewers, has a subtle existential endurance that is missing in the anguished lives of the sophisticated middle classes and agonized intellectuals. Even in Close Up, 1990, where he makes a powerful statement about the younger generation's fascination with cinema, we can detect threads of innocence gone astray. The leading character in the film, Hossein Sabzian, an imposter who plays himself in this reconstruction of a true story, is on trial for pretending to be the well-known film director of the time, Mohsen Makhmalbaf, born 1957. An affable man of humble background, Sabzian has gone so far as to convince members of an affluent but naive middle-class family, also playing themselves, to finance his next imaginary film project. He has also motivated the family's young son, who is dreaming about becoming a filmmaker. In dissecting the narrative, Kiarostami carries viewers with him to share an insight into Sabzian's mind. The imposter did not wish to be wealthy or powerful or even famous. Rather, he aspired to a cultural sophistication that would allow him to convey his vision through films, much as his hero did. Sabzian's quest was symbolic of a generation enamored of cinema because it is an escape from the harsh, almost surreal realities of post-revolutionary times. In The Circle, 2000, by Ja'afar Panahi, born 1960, the inescapability of the vicious cycle of everyday life becomes ever more apparent, especially for its younger victims of the society's harsh and unfair realities. It juxtaposes the lives of six young women in Tehran of the 1990s and their struggles in the face of misogynistic mores, family tyranny, and above all, the long arm of the state. The film's female characters represent a cross-section of crushed lives as these fellow travellers endure deprivation across a sea of fear and denial. This is an accidental sisterhood whose members understand one another's unwanted and undeserved fates. What is remarkable is that they are not devoid of human agency and are not merely passive recipients of what society or authorities impose on them. Yet, by escaping their homes in search of freer lives, they encounter severe desperation that drives them to prostitution, unavoidable abortion, abandonment of their children, and jail, repeatedly. Such is the outcome, as The Circle powerfully underscores, of 3 decades of morality police and the project of Islamification. Equally poignantly, women directors dealt with the plight of women with a naked realism and palpable rage. Two Women, 1999, by Tahmineh Milani, born 1960, one of several movies she produced with feminist themes, narrates the lives of 2 young women over a period of 14 years at the outset of the revolution. Out of economic desperation and under family pressure, the talented but unprivileged character quits school during the Cultural Revolution and, under pressure, enters into a marriage that exposes her to her husband's tyranny and abuse. The Islamic legal code is squarely in the husband's favour, leading to a tragic ending for which Milani condemns male-dominated society and its failings. Yet, similar to the characters of the cycle, the women resist becoming objectified and passive, an aspiration rather than reality, perhaps, but emblematic nevertheless of the changing female awareness at all levels. In Under the Skin of the City, 2000, Rakhshan Bani Etemad, born 1954, another talented woman director with an impressive cinematic record, portrays the sufferings of a humble textile worker who, besides the absence of an oppressive husband, is subject to destructive forces beyond her control. Here, an unhappy daughter with an abusive husband, a dissident son on the run, another son who desires to leave Iran at any cost, even at the cost of ransoming the family house to loan sharks, and later, in desperation, smuggling heroin, brings the mother to utter despair. Such a profusion of social troubles may seem rather forced if we overlook the urgency by which Bani Etemad brings her symbolic message home. As much as the new wave of Iranian cinema reflected social ills and personal anguish, it also pointed at an emerging Iranian identity decidedly separate from the ideals of the state. The popular appeal of most of these movies, beyond highbrow viewers and international festivals, where they received many awards and accolades, points to the public's desire to see their reality unmasked and their agonies surface, even if the censorship does not permit its full exposure. Such a collective wish elevated the role of cinema in Iran beyond entertainment and leisure into a powerful instrument of dissent, unmatched in its scope and impact by literary or other modes of cultural expression. The potency of this message of dissent played a major part in elevating Iranian cinema, as early as the 1960s, but more poignantly since the Islamic Revolution, to internationally acknowledged standards. Asghar Farhadi's A Separation, 2011, clearly relayed such a message to audiences at home and abroad. A Separation is about the painful divorce of a young middle-class Tehran couple, Nader and Simin, whose daughter is involuntarily caught in their wrangling over custody. Simin wishes to leave Iran and settle abroad, whereas Nader does not wish to sever ties, emotional and familial, to his country. The couple's motive for separation, to which Farhadi, born 1971, clearly alludes, is more societal than personal. It is as if they have been left no choice but to part ways. To take care of his elderly father, who suffers from dementia, Nader hires a caretaker. As much as the father's situation is a very real human one, he is also a metaphor for the burden of a rapidly vanishing past. The caretaker is a working-class woman with an outlook shaped by the traditional Shi'i code of conduct, one that is blessed by the Islamic Republic. The complex plot revolves around the suspicion of theft, for which the caretaker is subjected to an act of alleged violence by Nader. The ambiguity surrounding the event involves the caretaker's husband, an unemployed worker with nervous demeanour, who takes upon himself the mission of protecting his wife and preserving his honour. The story masterfully portrays generational, class, cultural, and gender tensions in today's Iran, while also depicting the multiplicity of reality and ambiguities surrounding human relationships. One of the most important features of the film is its ability to humanize the Iranian society's dilemmas and tensions. The film's enthusiastic reception worldwide, which included being awarded the Golden Bear at the Berlin International Film Festival, a Golden Globe Award, and Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film in 2011, denoted its universal appeal, for it was able to present the Iranian couple not in an exceptional Iranian light, but as a microcosm of a global phenomenon. As much as cinema appealed to younger Iranians, classical Persian music and its remarkable revival in the post-revolutionary era projected the other side of the quest for cultural autonomy. Reclaiming the Persian musical tradition in the face of the Islamic State's initial rejection was not only an act of defiance, but also a window onto a fascinating world where the confluence of music and poetry brought back to the present centuries of collective memory. Persian lyrical poetry combined with songs of the constitutional and early Pahlavi eras and examples of Kurdish lari and other pastoral melodies served as a cultural ground for this recovered cultural past. A number of musicians and composers with roots in the pre-revolutionary era contributed to the flourishing musical scene. Great virtuosi of the Pahlavi era aside, among the younger artists, Hossein Alizadeh, born 1951, followed a well-trodden path in Iran's musical modernity by employing Persian melodies to compose brilliant ensemble music and film music. His work proved on par with the best of contemporary classical music worldwide. His 1983 Neynava, a concerto for the Persian ney, reed pipe, and string orchestra, consisting of five interconnected pieces based on melodies, gushes, in the Nava mode, combined Persian and Western string instruments to deliver a melodically absorbing and technically intricate composition. Reminiscent of the famous opening passage of Rumi's Masnavi, it is a melodic conversation between the string orchestra, representing the vibrating human vocal cords, and the sound of the ney, representing the inspired melody that, according to the Sufi thought, is divinely embedded in the human chest. The riveting finale, Ragza Sama, dance and music, is inspired by the ecstatic dance and music of Sufi gatherings. A prolific artist, Alizadeh also composed the 1989 Torkaman, a set of instrumental pieces for the Persian setar. In the 14 improvised pieces that constitute Torkaman, Alizadeh employed the Persian Radif system to capture melodies, sounds, and sceneries of Iran's northeastern frontier of Torkaman Sarha. With a rare technical ability, he explores setar's possibilities of producing a range of musical impressions, from galloping horses in the steppe to the wailing of Turkmen mourners. Alizadeh is versatile in utilizing folk melodies and local musical instruments from all over Iran, features that made his music daring and innovative. As in Bezai's Bashu, or Kiarostami's trilogy on Iranian village life, and Akhavan Salesi's Kazideh, eulogizing Iran, many of Alizadeh's compositions are tributes to Iran's vanishing ethnic and regional diversity, a subconscious effort, perhaps, to withstand forces of cultural homogeneity. Mohammad Reza Lotfi and Parviz Meshkatian, 1955-2009, also utilized rural and nomadic tunes to capture the revolutionary spirit of their time and compose some of the most memorable songs of the era. The tangible absence of female performers and vocalists, however, because of the Islamic Republic's ban on women performing in public, exposed a major lacuna. Yet the ban did not deter women from excelling in Persian music in private. Vocalist Parisa was among the best of her generation in mastering classical radif and offering new renderings of the old Qajar songs. Some of her early concerts in the Shiraz Arts Festival adhered to the radif performance as pioneered a half a century earlier by Gamar al-Muluk Vaziri, who was among the first women to record Persian classical music in the 1920s and 1930s. Perhaps the most distinguished figure of Persian musical revival since the 1970s, however, is Mohammad Reza Shajarian, a master vocalist of remarkable quality and range. His popularity over the years has given him an iconic position, free of state patronage and immune to its infringement. Born in 1931 in Mashhad to a religious family, his father was a teacher and professional reciter, Gari, of the Quran. He grew up to be not only a marvelous reciter of the Quran, and for a while an elementary school teacher in villages of northern Khorasan, but also a serious student of Persian radif. Initially a self-taught vocalist, he listened to radio broadcasts and musical records made by former masters before receiving any systematic training. Overcoming the traditional stigma of becoming a professional singer, he performed first in Radio Mashhad and from 1966 on Radio Iran's celebrated Golha program, where he had his first national exposure. His career, spanning more than 40 years, made him an undisputed master of Persian music and a symbol of artistic integrity. Having been able to perform in the pre-revolutionary era, during the revolution, and later under an Islamic regime that frowned upon, if not outright banned, the production and performance of music outside its official domain. He gleaned from most of the masters of his time a vast repertoire of melodies and singing techniques, intricate details of tasnifs, diverse folk music of Iran, especially Khorasan, and music of the Shi'i mourning rituals. With a fine taste for selecting Persian poetry for his concerts and albums, Shajarian has conveyed with subtlety his messages in carefully composed performances. Refusing to perform on the Islamic Republic's radio and television networks in protest to their miscasting of his music, in a 1982 concert he recited a well-known ghazal of Hafez. This concert, released on a 1986 album, was titled Bidad, Injustice, a play on a gusheh in the Homayun mode. Hafez's ghazal wistfully reminiscing an idyllic past, well fit the mood of Shajarian's audiences, discouraged by the strange turn of revolution's fortune. Friendship I see naught. What befallen to friends? When affection came to pass? What happened to lovers? No jewel unearthed from the mine of camaraderie for years. What happened to the heat of the sun, the might of the wind and the rain? Ours was the land of companions, Share Yaran, and the soil of sun priests, Mer Banan. When did camaraderie, Mer Bani, end? Where are the princes of the realm, Shar Yaran? Hundreds of thousands of flowers bloomed, and not a single bird sang. What happened to the nightingales? Where are the songsters? Silent, O Hafez! No one knows mysteries of the providence. From whom do you ask what befell at the turns of the time? References to camaraderie lost, to his barren land that once belonged to sun priests, an allusion to the ancient Zoroastrians in Fars province, to perished princes of the realm, another allusion to a princely patron of the poet, to silent nightingales, probably the poet-singer himself, and finally to mysterious turns of fortune, deeply resonated with audiences, who may have identified with Hafez's allusions to injustices of their own time and misfortunes of the revolutionary course. In his 1999 Ahang-e-Wafa, Song of Faithfulness, Shajarian included an old song with lyrics by Bahar, the poet of the Constitutional Revolution, and composed by the celebrated Gholam Hussein Darvish, 1872-1926, possibly in 1915, when most of Iran had come under Russian and British occupation. The message resonated with Shajarian's audiences 8 decades later. It is all gloom and doom. Will a dawn to our night ever bloom? Our homeland has no other cure but to wait and endure. Poor Bahar, stop moaning, for there is no use in sobbing and sighing. Shajarian had to add a note to the album's leaflet, presumably at the request of the Ministry of Islamic Guidance, stressing that the song was composed at the end of the Qajar era and reflects conditions of that time. He also dropped the final line in Bahar's lyric, "From both directions they smack on her head," that is, Iran, "she who doesn't have a double-edged blade." A Green Sedition. In June 2009, the Green Movement, Janbeshe Sabz, brought to the surface among the urban middle classes these undercurrents of discontent with the Islamic Republic and its devious ways. Triggered by the presidential election campaigns of 2 opposition candidates, Mir Hossein Mousavi, born 1942, and Mahdi Karoubi, born 1937, who were running against the incumbent President Ahmadinejad, the Green Movement brought millions to the streets of the capital and provincial centres. They were the largest demonstrations that Iran has seen since the early days of the revolution 3 decades earlier. Both challenging candidates were among the regime's insiders, Mousavi being the former prime minister between 1981 and 1989, and Karoubi, a ranking cleric who served a number of times as speaker of the Majlis. They were hailed by the public and welcomed as realistic alternatives to Ahmadinejad's presidency. What motivated the campaign rallies to transform into a mass protest movement, more than the relative credibility of the opposition candidates, was Ahmadinejad's disastrous presidency, Khamenei's flawed judgment, and the Islamic Republic's fearful elite. The vote rigging in favour of Ahmadinejad that reinstated him in office were followed in succeeding days by the Supreme Leader's endorsement of the rigged election. His approval, coming after an equally flawed inquiry by the Guardian Council, confirmed the regime's audacity to enforce a lie. The subsequent clampdown on the rallies, mass arrests of protesters, barbaric torture in detention centres, and secret murders of detainees further displayed a willingness to use whatever means were at the regime's disposal to crush any voice of opposition. The mass trials in front of television cameras, when large numbers of leaders of sedition, Saranne Fetne, were tried and given heavy sentences, were reminiscent of the Soviet-style trials of the Stalin era. The Green Movement, named after the green colour adopted by the protesters, above all demonstrated popular demand for liberalization, democracy, and accountability. It revealed to the Islamic regime, to the international community, and to the hundreds of thousands who gathered in Meydan Azadi in Tehran, Meydan Naqsh-e-Jahan in Isfahan, and elsewhere in Iran, the existence of popular dissent among the predominantly young middle classes. After 30 years of the regime's Islamification, failed economic policies, international isolation, and ethnic, religious, and cultural repression, people had not sunk into submission. Although the Green Movement was crushed, the hope for change is unabated. There is hope for a more open and more tolerant state that allows for its citizens to flourish, to emerge from decades of isolation, and for the revolution to bear unspoiled fruit. Soon after, the authorities labelled the Green Movement as a fetne, Arabic fitna, meaning sedition, so as to discredit it in the eye of the public as an act of rebellion against the just cause of the Islamic government. Yet, seemingly unbeknownst to the regime, the concept of fetne in Islamic history, and even with the greater resonance in Iran's historical experience, carried an intricate subtext. As much as in the hand of the authorities, fetne could be used to denounce and to stamp out the dissent, fetne also conveys a sense of rebellion against the unjust rule, a notion perhaps closest to the modern concept of a popular revolution. Even in Shi'i apocalyptic prophecies, the advent of the Mahdi, the Lord of the time, is preceded by a fetne, one that eventually topples the dark age of the Antichrist, known as the Dajjal, and paves the way for the establishment of the Mahdi's just and equitable order. It was as if 3 decades of resting in power had made the authorities in the Islamic Republic forget not only the fact that the 1979 revolution was a fetne, but also the very Shi'i prophecies that they had studied, or ought to have studied, in the madrasas of Qom. Epilogue. The Islamic Revolution of 1979 and its aftermath not only brought down the Pahlavi regime and dismantled its elite, it also allowed, for the first time in Iran's long history, the Shi'i clerical establishment to assume political power. The magnitude of this paradigmatic shift and the way a conservative Shi'i establishment transformed into a radical force of dissent becomes all the more striking when we set the Islamic Revolution in the broader political and cultural contexts of the past 5 centuries. The unravelling of the ancient pact between religion and state, the pillars of an ancient social order with a conservative worldview, did not occur in a vacuum. As discussed in Part 3, it was the outcome of a project of the state's secular modernity that, since the early decades of the 20th century, had shaped Pahlavi Iran. The trajectory, which gave the state far greater economic and political autonomy in implementing a top-down program of secularizing and centralizing reforms, gradually alienated the bazaar and the clergy, which in turn eroded Iran's delicate socio-cultural balance. In the middle decades of the century, the quest for economic sovereignty and the national movement under Mossadegh did not succeed in dislodging Pahlavi because of foreign intervention, but more so because state-religion ties endured. The Shi'i clerical establishment, in effect, was the beneficiary of the Pahlavi restoration. It consolidated without giving full allegiance to the state. To understand how a program of state modernization in the Pahlavi era could be carried through independently of the religious establishment, but also independently of a grassroots democratic process, we must look back at the circumstances in the 19th century, as discussed in Part 2, whereby a number of factors, including the meagre economic resources at the government's disposal, made even selective reforms a formidable task. Long-standing geopolitical pressures from neighbouring empires, suppression of indigenous ideas of reform and renewal, as in the Babi movement, and the aborted state-sponsored reform under Amir Kabir, all hindered Iran's process of modernity. The experience of the constitutional revolution clearly demonstrated domestic and foreign obstacles to forging a constitutional regime. While the indigenous dissidents among the preachers and their bazaar support successfully challenged both the Qajar state and the authority of the conservative clergy, they succumbed to the interests of the landed nobility, to imperial vested interests, and eventually to the contingencies of security and territorial integrity that brought Reza Khan and his military cohort to power. Despite demographic and economic deficiencies, ineffective institutional reforms, and resistance to European intrusions, the geopolitical equilibrium that prevailed in the Qajar period allowed Iran to survive the direct onslaughts of its neighbours. This was not merely because of European imperial designs to preserve Iran as a buffer state, but more so because of renewed societal bonds and revival of a political culture that relied on the Persian model of kingship and appealed to the imperial memory of the Safavid past. The Safavid and the post-Safavid experiences, as discussed in Part 1, made Shi'ism a defining character of the state and a source of social cohesion and national identity. Resistance against hostile pressures on its frontiers and the forging of new commercial and diplomatic connections with the outside world helped tie the Safavid Empire to the Iranian plateau and set it apart from its Sunni nemesis to the west and east. To incorporate numerous regional entities into the guarded domains of Iran, the Safavid project of empire building also required a confederacy of the Gezilbash tribes, a political construct that in the long run generated new tensions between the political center and its periphery. After the collapse of the Safavid Empire, at least two attempts to restore the Safavid order were inconclusive, largely because the Afshars, and to some extent the Zands, aimed to substitute the Shi'i solidarity and renewal of the state religion bonds with other sources of loyalty. Beyond this sketch, looking for patterns over the course of half a millennium between the rise of the Safavid dynasty and the shaping of the Islamic Republic is a formidable task and possibly a hazardous one. Long-term historical trends, the longue durée, are subject to many exceptions in time and space. Yet they help place the seemingly fragmented course of events into a relatively coherent landscape. Iran has preserved its territorial integrity since the 16th century, despite domestic ups and downs and losses along its periphery. Its political sovereignty endured as well, against many odds. Military threats from mighty neighboring empires and nomadic and semi-nomadic incursions along its frontiers were not rare. The guarded domains of Iran, as it was traditionally known, survived in part because of a degree of decentralization along its provincial, ethnic, communal, and linguistic divides. The Iranian state and social order were fragile, and the forces in the periphery frequently resisted domination by the state. Yet they contributed to a relatively cohesive cultural and religious core. In the Persian political culture, maintaining the balance between the inland and the border, Persian Bum Vabar, and its synonym Marz Vabum, the frontier and the inland, was key to the security and prosperity of the guarded domains. The delicate balance between the sedentary center and the mobile periphery depended on justice, Persian Dad, Arabic Adl, an ancient principle of government and one of the five fundamental beliefs in Shi'ism. The injustice, bidad, as the Shahnameh frequently reminds its readers, destroys both the center and the frontier. Modern nationalism reinforced centralization and fostered greater social cohesion. The relative absence of ethnic hostilities since the early decades of the 20th century, in contrast to civil wars and cessions elsewhere in the post-colonial era, contributed to Iran's greater homogeneity. Using a tangible, though imperfect, analogy, Iran stood like an old mansion in the midst of a redeveloped neighborhood in which the plots have been awkwardly divided and the neighbors were, and still are, uncomfortable in their dwellings. The state continued to seek legitimacy by relying on memories of an imperial past and through claims to be the defender of the land of Islam and the Shi'i creed. It endured by maintaining an elaborate court, demonstrating the royal might, exemplary punishments, displays of generosity, and patronage of the religious establishment, as well as arts and poetry. A class of landed nobility who held ministerial posts in the Divan, and, to a lesser extent, those who enjoyed semi-autonomous tribal power, also sustained the state. Defeat in war and loss of territory in the early 19th century, however, diminished the Qajar state's prestige and tarnished its image. Through consent and occasional coercion, the state had to negotiate with urban notables, the ulama, the landed class, and the tribal khans, to preserve a precarious equilibrium. The most persistent obstacle, however, was lack of a rational division of labour between the court, dargah, and the divan. The interplay between the court and the bureaucratic elite was never fully regulated, despite repeated attempts to reform the system. Ministers never managed to secure their place at a safe distance from the rulers, and often suffered from the insecurity of their high office. It was to remedy this dysfunctional relation between court and bureaucracy that the discourse of reform was first introduced. Plans to restructure the state, a preoccupation of a westernizing minority within the Qajar elite, were never detached from a sense of decline that prevailed in the late 19th century, particularly as a material gap in comparison with Europe became more apparent and the weakening of the domestic economy more tangible. The urban elites, including members of the Divan and the tribal khans, controlled most of Iran's agrarian economy, which remained the most important source of wealth and state revenue before the 20th century. The land tenure system was a major tool of state patronage, but in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, private land ownership by the members of the Divan, affluent merchants, and even wealthy ulama was not uncommon. Throughout the period, but more visibly since the 17th century, Iran's subsistence agrarian economy was complemented by the introduction of cash crops, which changed the patterns of Iran's foreign trade. Silk, cotton, and later in the Qajar period, opium and tobacco, were exports that injected revenue into the Iranian economy and paid for the increasing volume of imports from neighboring lands and overseas. Despite Iran being at a migratory, commercial, and cultural crossroads in Eurasia, changes in the Central Asian caravan routes, the rise of the Uzbek Empire and other nomadic barriers, and the opening of new maritime routes to China brought Iran's ancient trade with East Asia to a virtual standstill. Iran's access to the Mediterranean and the Black Sea, too, was restrained, though never fully abandoned, after the rise of the Ottoman Empire, and later because of the Shi'i-Sunni conflict. The decline of the Mediterranean route and the Central Asian route, in turn, contributed in the 18th century to Iran's economic isolation and had a direct effect on the diminished wealth and the prosperity of its cities. In the 19th century, the Persian Gulf and the Caspian and Black Sea routes nevertheless revitalized foreign trade and brought greater prosperity to long-distance merchants and their associates. From late antiquity, Iran has always been an active partner in the Indian Ocean trade, but from the 17th century onward, through the southern maritime route, it gained access to European and East Asian markets and exported a variety of commodities, including silk, opium, tobacco, and carpets, and eventually oil in the 20th century. Yet, for reasons of geography, the difficult terrain, which made access to the interior cumbersome, the Persian Gulf and Caspian ports seldom sustained a powerful mercantile presence like that of Aleppo, Alexandria, Istanbul, or Mumbai. Iranians never became a serious seafaring nation in modern times, partly because of a lack of forests in the south to supply timber for shipbuilding. As a land-bound power, Iran had no navy to speak of, and nurtured no maritime, commercial, or colonial ambitions. Iran, moreover, did not seriously industrialize before the middle of the 20th century. Like other non-Western countries, Iran was further incorporated into the world market in the latter part of the 19th century. It supplied the European industrial powerhouses with cash crops, while increasingly becoming a market for Western manufactured goods. Iran's international trade in the 19th century mostly benefited the mercantile classes at the expense of local manufacturers. The most important of the export items, petroleum, however, was developed in the 20th century by the British, almost as if it were a colonial plantation commodity, with no direct Iranian input except unskilled labour. The urbanized mercantile classes, by and large, remained commodity traders rather than industrial manufacturers, but the Iranian bazaar remained a powerful site of their political protest. The Safavid Empire and its successors also relied on their subjects' loyalty through a state-enforced creed. By the middle of the 18th century, if not earlier, Iran had become not only a Shi'i state, but also a Shi'i society. Nader Shah's failure to revert back to the Sunni fold, or even position Shi'ism as an accepted creed within the Sunni realm, proved the depth of Iran's Shi'i conviction. As much as the majority of Iranians became more loyal to their faith, even as early as the middle of the 16th century, their Sunni neighbours were adamant to keep them as their heretical other. More than any other unifying force, what held together the sinews of Iranian ruling classes, the kingship, the nobility, the divan, the religious establishment, the large landowners, the urban notables, and even the tribal khans, proved to be the Shi'i religion. Shi'ism also served as the most important ingredient bonding the majority population in the cities and the countryside to the state and its ruling elites. The Safavids and the Qajars, and to a lesser extent the dynasties in between, posed as defenders of the faith. In reality, this meant that the state had to accommodate a clerical class, which by the 19th century came to acquire a semi-autonomous status. The sisterhood of the religious establishment and the temporal state, Din va Dowlat, which was at the heart of Persian political culture, at least since the Sasanian era, only renewed in the Safavid era and then again in the Qajar period. Up to the middle of the 20th century, the clergy remained in partnership, at least implicitly, with the dynastic state and the nobility. They coexisted, despite inherent tensions. Shi'ism as a national creed came to reinforce communal identity while avoiding active political involvement. Judicial authority did not rest solely with either the clerical establishment or the state. The blurred boundaries between the Sharia and customary laws were never straightened out before the implementation of modern legal codes during the Constitutional Revolution and later under early Pahlavi rule. The dual existence of the Mahdi in Shi'i beliefs and in Shi'i concept of authority, that he was presumed to be alive and yet hidden, proved a major obstacle to temporal legitimacy. The existence of the Mahdi not only potentially challenged the validity of the temporal state and any theoretical possibility of a just and equitable rule, but also gave the clerical establishment a collective authority on behalf of the Imam of the age. Before the latter half of the 20th century, Shi'ism never articulated a workable theory of government that reconciled temporal power with the utopian kingdom of the Mahdi. It never explicitly denied the validity of the institution of kingship, either. The ulama always remained indebted to the state for support and patronage. Instead, they invariably labelled anti-clerical and messianic movement as heretical and helped to silence them, although they could not stamp them out altogether or stop prophetic expressions that were inspired, directly or indirectly, by the messianic legacy inherent to the Iranian environment. The dynamics of priests versus prophets, to borrow a Weberian concept, proved one of the most enduring. The clerical authorities were never able to fully eradicate prophetic, speculative, philosophical, and mystical trends either. Nor were they in full control of folk Shi'ism or popular beliefs, also inherent to the Iranian environment and often the breeding ground for messianic aspirations. Despite a sustained air of intolerance, an uneasy equilibrium allowed for both formal and informal religions to coexist and even thrive. Movements of protest thus remained an integral part of the religious landscape and increasingly came to represent, in the 19th and 20th centuries, socio-economic dissent. Starting with the Safavi order itself in the 15th century, and followed by the Noctavi, Sufi Ne'amatullahi, the Sheikhi doctrine, and later the Babi movement, the Mahdi cult in Shi'ism contested clerical authority and its overly legalistic reading of religion. The antinomian ideas ingrained in all these movements sought an apocalyptic end to the Sharia, implicitly and at times explicitly. The dual existence of the Imam of the age and the possibility of his advent posed a unique tension within Shi'ism that went beyond mere theology. Despite a powerful appeal to the disenchanted, to the ordinary folks, and to communities on the religious fringe, messianic trends seldom withstood the onslaught of the state ulama symbiosis. Though they had survived in the Iranian world for centuries, they could convert only with clandestine networks. At the turn of the 20th century, the Constitutional Revolution, a form of secularized messianism, was an exception, and that succeeded only to a limited extent. Despite the state-clergy symbiosis that ensured some stability in the Qajar era, the structural handicaps of the Iranian political system paved the way for new outside challenges. Virtually throughout the period under consideration, Iranian borders, and at times the state's very existence, were threatened by geopolitical threats and foreign invasions. The dual Ottoman and the Uzbek threats, up to the middle of the 18th century, forced Iran into a two-front defense strategy. Any imperial expansion beyond Iran proper, such as Nader Shah's expedition to Iraq and Hindustan, therefore proved ephemeral and unsustainable. From the early 19th century, the competing strategies of the two European empires, Russia and Britain, introduced a north-south polarity into the region within which Iran stood as a buffer. The two European powers interfered with Iran's domestic affairs and compromised its sovereignty. Yet their strategies did not result in the Iranian state's total loss of political agency. It can be argued that Iran took advantage of its buffer status to stabilize and recover from devastation caused by political strife in the 18th century. Even though it lost territory and prestige, in the long run, Iran managed to gain strategically by acquiring a recognized status in the European imperial vista as a sovereign state. Iranians learned to confirm their survival not by means of confronting mighty armies in the battlefield, but by negotiation, backdoor deals, and even playing the European powers against one another. Despite lack of clear foreign policy and a paucity of administrative and economic resources before the Pahlavi era, Iran did not entirely succumb even to Europe's informal colonialism. The so-called Persian question in late 19th century diplomacy can be read as a prelude to Iran's fragmentation, as the 1907 agreement between Russia and Britain confirmed. Yet it could also be seen as the success of Iran's foreign policy in keeping the two powers at bay. During the Constitutional Revolution, both the Western-inspired reform and the indigenous messianic trends converged into a relatively coherent discourse, giving voice to an emerging urban intelligentsia and their demands to end arbitrary rule, open the political space, and create modern legislative and judicial institutions. The Constitutional Revolution should be seen as a moment in Iran's modern history when Western-inspired institutions of democracy, division of powers, popular representation, and individual freedoms were adopted into the Iranian environment and fused with aspirations for justice and renewal. Constitutionalism, moreover, was perceived as the key to material progress, secularism, centralization, and state-implemented reforms. The Constitutional Revolution weakened the Qajar's arbitrary rule, but ironically opened the way for the landowning nobility and their vested interests to gain more power without making the new democratic institutions any more effective. They, in turn, witnessed in the person of Reza Shah and his cohorts the making of a strong state, one of the chief objectives of the Constitutional Revolution. In the aftermath of the Constitutional Revolution and at the end of World War I, a large sector of the Iranian middle class and its intelligentsia by and large acquiesced to autocratic Pahlavi modernism as the only viable option for restoring Iran's threatened sovereignty and implementing long-awaited reforms. The rise of the Pahlavi state in the 1920s changed the patterns that had been set at least since the rise of the Safavids. State centralization reduced tribes' political and military power, marginalized the clerical establishment, and even dismantled the landowning class's hold over Iran's agrarian regime. With the aid of a non-tribal army, the Pahlavi state forever emasculated the nomadic periphery and, in effect, removed tribes as the most powerful player in the political life of the Iranian plateau. Forced sedentarization and, more important, the growth of urbanization transformed a highly mobile nomadic population. This was in consequential contrast to the survival of tribes and tribal networks in neighboring Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and parts of Central Asia. a socio-ethnically amalgamated Iran, at least since the 1960s, by coercive or by peaceful means, never again would experience a tribal resurgence. The double-edged sword of state modernization transformed the economy and infrastructure, built a new middle class, and reasserted Iran's sovereignty. These were the non-political objectives of the constitutional revolution. But it also built an oppressive autocracy that, backed by an effective army and police, was able to dismantle the political achievements of the constitutional era. Sustaining such a regime was greatly facilitated by Iran's oil revenue, a small portion of the Anglo-Persian oil company's total income, but enough to make the Pahlavi project a success. The Pahlavi ideology also facilitated, through the discovery of a new source of legitimacy by greater reliance on Iran's ancient past. Though Iran's national awareness and its sense of mytho-historical continuity had never faded, the new nationalist narrative of the Pahlavi era was keen to contrast the glories of distant past with the perceived decadence of the Qajar era. These notions of glory and decadence laid the foundation for a national memory that has lasted up to the present. Reza Shah's resolute personality also contributed to transforming Iran beyond anything it has experienced, at least since the rise of the Qajars. The material success of Pahlavi modernity demonstrated the importance of oil revenue as a transformative commodity. But unlike coal in 19th-century European industrialization, oil revenue proved a blessing toward the creation of a stronger state with an extracting economy rather than a resource for growth of the national bourgeoisie. Since 1953, oil revenue, irrespective of Iran's share of the proceeds and its legitimate claims for control of its natural resources, further strengthened the state at the expense of its citizens' political and civil rights. Undermining old political checks and balances, the monopoly of the oil income, which had sharply increased over decades, gave the Iranian state a unique opportunity to implement top-down modernization projects. It also provided the state with more tools of repression and control. The Islamic Republic only reaffirmed that pattern of political coercion that had been set during the Pahlavi rule. Growth of the population, urbanization, secular education, modern communication, and to some degree industrialization created new socio-political dynamics. In the aftermath of World War II, demands for economic sovereignty and nationalization of the oil industry echoed the discourse of decline and renewal, but also the political demands of the constitutional era. The downfall of Mossadegh in 1953, a critical moment in Iran's collective memory, denoted not only a showdown with Western geopolitical and economic interests, but also an old struggle between ministers and rulers. The defeat of the nationalization movement, at least in the way it was perceived by its chief actors, further traumatized the Iranian collective memory, for it denoted to the Iranian intelligentsia the ominous collusion of foreign and domestic forces working to quash Iran's legitimate demands. That it happened in the context of the Cold War and with the United States as the chief sponsor of the Pahlavi regime disillusioned a whole generation of intellectuals and sympathizers of the left. Control of natural resources continued to erode the state's accountability, reduce its compliance with people's political demands, and create, in effect, a rentier state with its own privileged class. The Islamic Revolution, in a way, was the final stage in a process that started in the Constitutional Revolution, continued in the post-war era with the National Movement, and later was redefined in the land reforms of the 1960s. The ideological element aside, the Islamic Revolution completed the dismantling of the old landed elites. More important, it diminished in size and influence a secularized middle class that was the backbone of the Pahlavi project of modernity. Yet the emerging middle classes under the Islamic Republic continued to follow the path of their predecessors. Even the inner clique of the Islamic regime, despite its ideological posturing and conspiratorial worldview, by and large has complied with the dictates of global markets and global communications. Despite an early claim of Islamic compassion, the revolution promptly employed all modern means of coercion and control even more intrusively. With the Islamic Revolution, another long-term historical process came to a head. Whereas the clerical establishment under the Safavids and their successors was nurtured by the state and patronized by it, in the post-constitutional era and under Pahlavi rule, it lost much of its institutional privileges and social prestige. Intellectually outcast and socially isolated, by the 1960s a new generation of clerics, mostly from humble backgrounds, began to attract a wider popular constituency, mostly by advocating a politicized interpretation of Islam. Aided by a radical ideology, it first opposed the Pahlavi state and later transformed into a revolutionary force. Ayatollah Khomeini and his militant clique borrowed elements of their ideology and rhetoric from the radical left, as much as they did from Islamic populists and repenting intellectuals of the left, and combined it with politicized readings of the Shi'i narrative. Yet the potency of Khomeini's message, and key to his success, was his ability to appropriate the messianic spirit inherent to the Shi'i heterodox milieu and exploit its martyrdom paradigm in his own favor. Yet, despite the Islamic Revolution's fervor and ideological mission, it did not essentially transform the state's interaction with society at large. The Islamic Republic shared too many authoritarian traits with its predecessor, in theory and practice, to be able to dislodge the state's institutional hegemony. But almost in all respects, it superseded its predecessor. It upheld the monopoly on power, repression of essential liberties, propaganda and indoctrination, nepotism and corruption, and control of the economy and natural resources in manners almost unprecedented in Iran's past. It also displayed conspiratorial traits to justify its militancy and monopoly of power. The conspiratorial approach to politics and history allowed for an easy escape from the painful realities and from having to assume responsibility for failures. Far more agency was given to the evil other, the An-Niran of the Iranian mythology, than to the immaculate self. Self could be celebrated only as victim and martyr. Repeated conspiracies from 1911 to 1953 and military occupations in the course of two world wars no doubt offered, and still offer, ample fodder for such a confined and fearful outlook. Post-revolutionary Iranian society nevertheless appears to have a different perspective from that of the state. There is a vibrant and eager younger generation, better informed about the world outside, and by and large immune to the state's militant ideological hegemony. The state's systematic efforts to reconstruct Iran in its own Islamic image have had mixed results. Despite a consistent effort and billions invested and wasted, the Iranian society has not turned, conceptually speaking, into a greater Qom. Nor are the prospects for such a metamorphosis very bright. Representations of an Islamic identity are amply displayed, and Islamification policies resolutely enforced in schools, workplaces, and the public space. Yet, under the surface, a tenacious quest for alternative identity motivates a vast sector of Iranians, especially urban youth. Disillusioned with the revolution's unfulfilled promises and frustrated with the harsh realities of everyday life, most Iranians are in search of an alternative. However nebulous, the post-ideological ideals that younger Iranians are looking for seem to be culturally more sophisticated and more pluralist, as became amply evident during the 2009 Green Movement. The emerging generations, who are products of Iran's demographic revolution, are better nurtured, better educated, and often less romantically nationalist. They are, by and large, cynical about the regime's xenophobic outlook and its isolationist policies. The age of West toxification and imagining a strict bipolarity between the East and the West seems to be over. The mystique of another revolution that could bring about an ideological utopia is also safely dispelled. Yet the women and men whose future now hangs in the balance are often disillusioned by the prospect of ever freeing themselves from the shackles placed on them by an indoctrinating regime. Whether they succumb to the mold stamped on their society, or succeed in redefining Iran in their own image as an open and pluralistic society, remains to be seen. What is undeniable is that for 5 centuries, Iran produced paintings, music and architecture, fine craftsmanship, sustainable horticulture, irrigation and habitats, as well as poetry and philosophy, history and narratives, and, more recently, theatre and cinema, to reflect on, or perhaps to escape from, the cruelty, intolerance and fetters of conformity. Though in the past the best of these creative expressions were patronised by the state, they were shaped by motifs and memories of a complex cultural legacy, whether legendary, lyrical or religious. The sense of nationhood that consciously emerged in the 20th century and enforced by the state, Pahlavi or Islamic Republic, aimed to make the ethnic, linguistic, religious and regional diversity of the past conform to a generic nation of compliance and docility. Yet the collective memory that was passed along through generations persisted and helped define and redefine a national identity defiant of repressive authorities. Expressions of political discontent, utopian ideals and heretical visions often were couched in the language of metaphor that withstood censorship and pressure. Quests for alternative values, for cultural authenticity, and for moral change were seldom fulfilled, at least not in ways that their initiators intended or idealized them. However, grieving the loss of golden opportunities, disillusionment and anguish over what went wrong, resenting the abuses of power and mourning for lost chances, have always been the stuff of Iranian intellectual and artistic creativity. These were voices that endured despite suffering and material defeat and empowered the Iranian peoples. When Farrukh Farrukhzad wrote, "It is only the sound that endures, Tanha Sedast ke Mimand," she probably was pointing to this long and complex culture, perhaps the sum total of the best Iran ever offered. In this respect, she was echoing Hafez's memorable verse nearly 6 centuries earlier. "Anything sweeter than the sound of love I haven't heard. Memorable echoes remain under this revolving dome." Under Iran's revolving dome, sounds of memories are still echoing. This concludes Iran by Abbas Amanat. Narrated by Derek Perkins. Copyright 2017 by Yale University. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Yale University Press and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.